Yeah, I have the distinct honor of being the last presenter to you guys, and I will not take any offense if you guys got to grab a plane and get out of here, or you just get bored of me. So that's okay. So first, there is a lot of overlap between the last presentation. So you're going to see some things in my slide that I'm going to kind of glance over, just because I don't want to, you know, belabor a lot of those issues. And we'll talk a little bit more about the legal and international governance associated with, I'm going to use the word three-parent IVF just because it's easier to use, but of course mitochondrial replacement therapy is another term that's maybe more appropriate, MRT. And there's a number of different science, law, and regulatory policy issues that have been fragmented because of this disruptive technology, and we'll call it a disruptive technology because it indeed is. And the main theme of a lot of this is that regulatory systems and regulatory science tend to respond poorly when it comes to disruptive technology, whether it be mHealth, whether it be e-cigs. But regulatory frameworks have a hard time catching up with this stuff and often are reactive instead of proactive. So I have no relationships to disclose, but the one disclosure I do want to make is a lot of this work was done by my graduate student, Johanna Chandera. I'm fortunate to have a group of graduate students that really like all this interesting stuff. And she was planning on presenting today but couldn't come, so I just want to acknowledge her, especially since she did the slides. So again, as a presentation agenda, I just want to say we're going to briefly go over mitochondrial disease and MRT, policy fragmentation between the U.S. and U.K., which you already saw a lot of in the last presentation, the international governance side, which was also touched upon, and we'll really talk about future challenges and policy recommendations to address this issue. Again, one of the things to note that's important is the macro international policy environment doesn't operate in isolation. So a lot of times these type of issues that are transnational in nature, including transnational commercial surrogacy, which has a component where, you know, if one state doesn't have, and when I say state, a country, has very permissive laws on the issue, then it allows for transnational trade in like commercial surrogacy to the lowest common denominator. Or it's just a issue of policy is fragmented and people don't know why a child remains stateless. It's because two countries have two different laws on it. So it's really important to develop some consensus at the international level, even though it's arguably very hard to do that. So we'll talk about that. So you saw the same statistics, but approximately 1 in 4,000 children are born with a maternally inheritable mitochondrial disease that are linked to a number of multi-syndromes and multi-organ syndromes. So these are, again, can be mild and also potentially devastating diseases. And unfortunately, you know, we have 250 different mutant mitochondrial DNA mutations that have been identified, but the mechanism of action for a lot of these mutations hasn't been well defined. So that leads to the question of, yes, it's a dangerous disease, it's inheritable, but we don't have the appropriate diagnostics to really determine you know, the scope of the disease and also the prevalence of a lot of these diseases that are attached. That also impacts therapeutics, because a lot of times you're not sure exactly what type of therapeutic intervention you need for these diseases, one, because they're multi-organ and they're multi-system, but also because you don't understand the mechanism of action. So again, these are very difficult questions that have not yet been addressed, but are of course advancing through genetic research, et cetera. So again, it's been quoted, more than 12,000 women in the U.S., and this goes back to the surveillance issue, where we really don't have really good data outside of certain developed markets about how many people are potentially at risk for these genetically inheritable diseases. So the technique we already talked about is really a specialized version of in vitro fertilization. That's why it's categorized as a specialized ART, in which, of course, the nucleus is removed from the patient's egg, the parent's egg, their intended parent's egg, and inserted into the cytoplasm of a donor's egg with healthy mitochondrial. And, of course, the sperm being the third parent, of course, in that kind of relationship. There are generally two techniques, spindle transfer and pronuclear transfer. I won't get into the details of that. But the overall goal, of course, is to avoid mitochondrial disease transmission or inheritance to future child. And, you know, the cascading effect here is you could potentially have that transmission reduced in future generations as well. So there is, you know, from the standpoint of a public health, you know, lens, an ability to, one, reduce the incidence and prevalence of these diseases, but also it's possible that you could envision something of more of an elimination or eradication of a lot of these diseases. should, you know, it be successful and safe and ethical and all those other questions we haven't addressed appropriately yet. Despite that, UK has decided to move forward and become the only country to legalize the practice in human subjects. And as the previous speaker already noted, this is not within the context of a clinical trial or a, you know, a controlled environment, though it will be heavily regulated. But it's not most of the data that will be derived from these candidates will be observational and not in an RCT format, so it's going to be hard to show any efficacy associated with it. So, you know, that's one of the components of design here, which policy may dictate a lot of design when it comes to evidence base for this approach. So again, the HIFA Act is important because it is a specific legislation that deals with, you know, treatment involving human embryos and related clinical practice when it's associated with genetic modification. So they have regulations that specifically address this, and we'll get into why this is important in just a second. And as we already discussed, this is an act that did not permit the use of mitochondrial DNA altered for treatment. So what happened was a legislative intervention where they amended that act to specifically allow and extend the definition of permitted eggs to include those that are going to be used for three-parent IVFs. So again, you see this intervention at the policy level specifically because you can't do it. So that's a very different component when you look at a comparative legal analysis. If you have a law on the books that says you can't do something, you have to act to do something to change that law. So it's very proactive. I mean, it's a very intended thing that they're trying to do versus a country that may not have a law on the books and will then try to allow the practice just under its current legislative framework. So that's a very different approach. It's very important as well. And the one common theme here is also HFEA is a regulatory agency with a specific remit to deal with genetic modification when it comes to reproductive technologies or what is more appropriate, genetic engineering, not genetic modification. So again, they have a specific regulatory authority that deals with this, whereas in a lot of countries, they don't even have a drug regulatory authority that really has a good handle on our standard therapeutic, you know, drugs, biologics, and medical devices. So again, this is a very mature market from a regulatory standpoint. So again, on February 2015, Britain's House of Lords and Commons completed the process of parliamentary approval. They have a very different style of government over there. So that's another component of how this type of legislation can get passed easier than in comparison to the U.S. here. And that will lead to the implementation of a proposed set of regulations that are now final, and they will begin the process of creating a licensing and regulatory framework to operationalize three-parent IVF. That includes extending their existing regulatory platform that deals with in vitro fertilization and ART, to adapt it and make it more robust for three-parent IVF. That includes a licensing scheme that will look at the clinic itself and also the candidates itself that was talked about, 10 to 20 candidates per year perhaps. I'm not sure exactly what the patient uptake is yet, but that's the plan. On the U.S. side, we kind of talked about it, but we'll go over it one more time, is that, and the most important thing to note is the FDA doesn't have the same regulatory remit as HFEA has when it comes to genetic engineering within the context of reproductive technology. So the FDA technically would have a hard time, you know, kind of regulating this space because it's just not under its specific congressional remit. So again, when you have a dedicated agency that deals with these issues, they have a better time adopting legislation or regulations to address the specific issue. And in the case of FDA, that's not really clear yet. So there may have to be some legislative change or some process that occurs in order to make it more clear. The same issue comes up with stem cells as well. So there's a lot of disruptive technologies that actually are great case studies for this. And something as simple as mHealth, where the FDA is having a hard time differentiating if a mobile health device is a medical device versus, you know, something more innocuous like a legal dictionary or a medical dictionary, sorry. And then NIH also has a very big role to play because they have policies that specifically prohibit the review of any applications. And if you're in a soft money environment like me, for any type of applications for funding that include genetic modification or germline modification. On the international side, there's a large body of international law that builds consensus that no germline modification should actually, should undergo genetic modification, and this was also discussed. But essentially, the Parliamentary Assembly for the Council of Europe, PACE, used a lot of international human rights law and also existing UN declarations and also things from civil society, such as the World Medical Association Declaration, to support their position that this, specifically three-parent IVF, would be in contravenience to international human rights law. So again, on one side you have, and I'm going to try to explain this, the UK, which is being very progressive about their regulatory science on this space, the US, which is still trying to figure it out. We talked about the Institute of Medicine. The FDA did convene an expert panel where they found that the preclinical data didn't support use in clinical trials for this particular technique of three-parent IVF. So they're still deciding. They're still kind of figuring it out, especially the ethic component or the social science component is a little bit harder. And then you have, globally, it's just not allowed. And that's based upon, again, international human rights law primarily. You also have a divergence of what agencies are in charge of this. So again, the UK has a dedicated agency devoted to this specific issue. The FDA does not, so that's probably why they're having a little bit of a harder time dealing with this. And then from an international perspective, you have multiple international organizations, some of which are more specific to the issue and some that are less. So again, it's only legal in one country. That's the bottom line. Now, some of the challenges, and I'm finishing up, is that this is not the first case study of a disruptive technology which we really can't fit into an existing regulatory framework. And with the advance of biomedical technologies, including if any of you guys are interested in synthetic biology, which is another game changer in disruptive technology, where you can create organisms and you can also actually manufacture pathogens, we're in a space in the 21st century where these disruptive technologies were really going to impact our regulatory science and how we approach legal ethics and social issues in the context of health. So again, there's no international consensus on this issue, the three-parent IVF issue, and a study that surveyed 16 countries found that many of these countries don't even have infrastructure to support genetic modification regulation. Most of it's still considered very experimental, so the human health component is not well tied in. So some of the things we think are important is that there has to be some discussion at the international level for consensus on the issue. And I know some of that's been going on, but the most important things to assess is whether, of course, it's ethical to use the technology and whether it's safe or not. So I don't think observational studies are going to tease that out in the UK, and I don't think that's really an acceptable platform to develop evidence-based policymaking. And unfortunately, I think the UK example is going to be used as a case study, whether it's successful or not, even though it's likely not to generate a lot of evidence-based medicine. So one of the other lessons is if you want to deal with this, you probably should have a dedicated regulatory agency that specifically has the technical expertise to deal with this. That includes having people from bioethics panels, of course, geneticists, et cetera. FDA has those expertise, but they don't have the specific regulatory remit to deal with these issues. So you need the expertise, and you need the legislative support from a lawmaking perspective. And again, I think one of the most important things I'm a global health guy is, for markets that are mature and they don't know what to do with this issue, they really need technical assistance from international organizations and other partners to try to kind of deal with this. So one of the concerns we have is the case study of stem cells, where we've done a lot of work on internet advertising of stem cell clinics, and you'll find there's all types of stem cell clinics everywhere in China and Thailand and et cetera, and there's no science to support a lot of the work that they're doing, especially in autologous stem cell transfer. So you could envision this technology, because it's adopted in the UK, spreading to markets that are less regulated, that are also less mature and have less patient safety protections because there's no international consensus on it. So one potential solution is to engage at the UN level, and that includes actually an initiative that exists called the Biotechnology Initiative. It's called the and it's developed at the UN Secretariat at a very high level, reports directly to the UN General Assembly and also, of course, the Secretary General. And it provides a wide range of knowledge and tools to support development efforts and global policy issues. And their specific remit is genetic modification, as well as synthetic biology and human health. And they engage with a lot of different partners, including regulatory agencies, including the private sector, et cetera. And we think this is a good platform to at least get some of this discussion going on and to build maybe not international consensus, but at least raise awareness to the issue and try to develop a set of best practices from a safety and an ethical perspective. Again, the bottom line on this issue is there's a lot of policy fragmentation going on. It's a disruptive technology. And in addition, we really don't have a good idea of the patient safety implications associated with it. So we hope that there'll be some international action on this issue. So thanks.
Well, again, I want to thank you for sticking this out. I can't believe I've had a panel where everybody stayed on or below time. I've never had this happen. It makes my job so much easier. So what for the last few minutes, because now we have time for questions, I want to invite the audience any questions. Clearly, if you've been sitting here this long on the last day, in the last session, you are vested in this topic. So any questions for Cynthia, Susan, Marcy, Timothy, or me, please. Speak up. Yes. I'll just answer quickly. I'm Lee Warners from CDC. We are mandated, so Susan mentioned the Fertility Clinic Success Rate and Certification Act, yeah. 1992, that under congressional mandate, we have to collect data and report on the success rates of every IVF cycle done in the U.S., and we've had this ongoing annually, put on annual reports. There's about 175,000 cycles a year, and probably 70,000 births now, so it's about 1%, 1.5% of births. I did want to make a comment, though. One of you guys put some ads up there. This law came about because there were some fertility clinics that were misreporting their success rates and kind of jacking their rates up, and that's why CDC received the mandate to collect data on and report data annually on success rates for clinics. It goes both ways, though, because some of the clinics patients seeking fertility services, particularly IVF, may go to clinics that have higher success rates. The way for a clinic to get a higher success rate is to only select patients with a good prognosis. So it goes back to what Timothy's saying. We don't really have randomized trials, and we are trying to work on this at CDC, how we report the cycles. Dimitri Kitson, who leads our team for ART, has put a new measure in the report, not just whether it was any live birth, but what's the success rate with a singleton live birth, which if you're trying to balance success with best health, that's probably the best one. Were you part of that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I figured. Any grassroots effort, women's health, Cynthia Pearson.
No,
and that's a problem.
Yeah.
And it's a huge problem. And so what I said in my talk, it's only for IVF. So we aren't getting any type of ovulation induction methods, Clomid, anything like that. But that's estimated to be 3 to 4 times more common, at least, than ART. It's not regulated in any way. We don't even have, I mean, CDC is not a regulatory body, FDA is, but we don't even have data on this. We're actually working on a way to try and get some type of surveillance going in that area. It's sorely needed.
It's really tough research to help impact on the women who go through the procedure. So that HR, quite a while, funded pretty good quality research on the longer term health effects on women who receive the procedures and then attempted to birth the baby. And it's so dang complicated because those women, by definition, have sort of some reason why they're different, unless it's just strictly a male contribution. And so teasing out, do the treatment increase the risk of breast cancer? Well, when you take a look, the existence of infertility is trying to get pregnant with a man and not increases your risk of breast cancer. Ovarian cancer, who knows, there's not enough of them. So the best data that I know of, maybe no more, is from Israel. And they're really invested in helping women get pregnant and have babies, and they really good data collecting their systems. So they're sort of taking out more of the long-term effects on the women who then, you know, have the treatment and have the baby. These young women who don't come in with pre-existing conditions, presumably are fertile as all get out because they're in their 20s and otherwise healthy. We know in absolute terms what risk they might encounter on the short term. We don't know relative terms how likely the risk is, and we don't know nothing about the long term effects.
And if I just may comment on the surveillance side from kind of a legal and policy perspective, I think there's some room for states to innovate within that space within the context of licensure. Because a lot of that data can be captured at the provider level if it's mandated as a component of licensure. And then you can match that data up at the sub, you know, at the subnational level to a secondary data set like NHANES or some other data that's available. So I think, again, it takes a progressive state that recognizes that this particular issue is a significant issue in their state, and then to link that up to provider level surveillance, which is kind of difficult policy wise, but you've got the medical society who don't want to do it. But still, I mean, it's one idea.
I mean,
go ahead. Getting any kind of legislation like that, even in progressive states of California, we tried to get a law about advertising. We just wanted to clean up the advertising, and the clinics were wholeheartedly against it, and all we were able to achieve was that if a broker or clinic registered with ASRM, then they were not subject to the law. But the cycle, of course, is that we know that, unfortunately, that ASRM, first of all, it's not a regulatory body, but second of all, it doesn't have enforcement mechanisms. So it's been very, very difficult. Other than the Dartmouth and the Dartmouth study, clinics are not referring to any provider. So we really need answers to how to make some of this.
I want to make one comment, and then I see your hand up. So we are collecting data on egg donors in the National HIV Surveillance System, including age and race, ethnicity, but you're saying we don't have the health characteristics and the impact.
Yeah.
Let's talk. Maybe there's a way we can't get a national surveillance. Maybe some sentinel clinics might be able to collect some of that data. Okay. Yes.
Drivers are
allowed. But so the stated policy in the UK is one, of course, because you have this legislative issue that bars you from doing it, so you got to act. The second component was for related healthcare costs. So for those individuals that do inherit a mitochondrial disease, there's an impact on cost, although prevalence numbers are not very good. But one of the stated goals, at least by the UK, was, again, that you could lower healthcare costs. So that was one component of their decision-making process. Now, in the context of how has it been positively received, it's always the problem with this, what we call dual-use technology. Dual-use technology is pretty commonly used in the context of synthetic biology, where a technology has the potential to do very good, and it has a potential, unknown potential to do harm. But generally speaking, within the context of media and et cetera, and more, you know, the gray literature, dual-use technology is the usual emphasis is on the good nature of it. So synthetic biology can be used to create new organisms and all types of weird stuff, but it can also be used as a bioterrorism weapon. That's well known as well. So, but most of the literature and most of the gray literature focuses on the you know, innovative side of it. So that's one component. And then the last question, I think, was why aren't there any clinical trials? In the U.S., it's clear. I mean, there's no preclinical support for the use of it in human subjects. That's why there's no clinical trials. And then, you know, you've got the exact opposite in the U.K. So it's a question of the policy environment. I think it's somewhat of a question of the advocacy environment, and it's also a question about stakeholder participation. So the Nuffield Bioethics Council was part of this consultation at the UK level. So it was a pretty broad consultation. And based upon that and public support for it, there was enough to sway the parliament. But again, a parliamentary system is very different from a U.S. legislative system. I would doubt even those three factors would lead to legislation in the U.S. So those are some answers.
Really like Gattaca. You mentioned this five times. I've seen that's a Halle Berry movie, right? What?
Yeah.
It's a great flick, I'll say.
So you're shaking your head. I'm wondering what your reaction is to this.
Oh no, Halle Berry is in it.
Oh.
Okay. Who's in Gattaca?
Uma Thurman.
Is it? Oh, you're right. Thank you. I'm thinking of a different movie. Yes, I will never correct Susan again in public.
Thank you.
appreciate your comment, and it's, you have an interesting observation about the 98 case versus what we're talking about with three-parent DNA. I'd never even thought about the two of them together, but it's a really good point. And the action plan, I mean, it took, I can't even tell you how much, I mean, it was constant battling to get that thing through. And it helps, as far as stigma, there is a lot of stigma with infertility, and so that resolve, they're really doing a lot, and you guys do too, to normalize it, that it is something that we can talk about. And I think the action plan is trying to demystify it or destigmatize it. I think it's slow, but we're making inroads. And if you go look at the Grand Rounds that I put the slide on, you can Google Grand Rounds CC Infertility. You can actually watch Barbara Calora talk about stigma and what they're doing to address it with National Infertility Awareness Week and all our events. So, but thank you for your comment.
Yeah, I think that stigmatization and the social constructs of infertility drive a lot of these processes that we have. I mean, it was great to hear the translation, the transnational commercial service issue, because the stigma goes different ways in that context. So it's a very unique social construct within each global society. And because we don't have a very good social acceptance of infertility, you have these kind of mechanisms
Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We are doing a lot on prevention, so I think what you're, I applaud your attempt to frame this in a positive way. But we've really honed it down to a very narrow segment. Was it 1 in 4,000 from mitochondrial? So, I mean, in a bigger sense, we are focused a lot on prevention. You see, just across CDC, across HHS, I mean, the plan has actually got people talking at least. I've gone to a lot of the meetings of ASRM. I'm a liaison to AUA. They're all interested in prevention. They really want to attack it on the front end. But it's a tough nut to crack.
I just draw one other thing, because we're going to respond to the population at the top, if I the move now to take a safer, modern, long-acting use of reversible contraceptives and really promote that these are safe, more effective than anything else that is used day-to-day or month-to-month, that is great for pregnancy prevention, not so great for fertility.
And I think just from a research perspective, because I'm more on the substance abuse side, it's looking at it from a risk environment framework, which is really looking at the macro issues and how it trickles down to the micro issues. So there's a lot of macro policy issues that influence each population and influence a micro decision at the individual level. So, you know, my infertility thing, I have two kids, one's 1.5, one's 3.5, but the reason why we wait is daycare costs me more than my mortgage. So that's just a macro policy environment issue where we don't support subsidization compared to other countries. And I think that risk environment changes as you go across different countries. And I think that's one of the challenges. We have pretty good, you know, we talk about having a hard time figuring out about infertility in the U.S. Think about the rest of the world. You know, it's a global problem.
Absolutely. Not as much, but African-American women have the highest rates of gonorrhea, chlamydia, tubal scarring. They're less likely to have access to infertility services, and when they do seek them, they tend to seek them later than their white and Latino counterparts. It's an issue.
And a disproportionate incidence of fibroids.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And the difficulty in getting access to fertility is very
Yeah.
And the fact that access to these treatments is really expensive.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as I said, the National Story of Family Growth Analysis is that, you know, that the overwhelming group of women who have, you know, access to services are highly educated, wealthy, white. And so it reflects the overall, you know, an overall dynamic.
Any more questions? I can't believe you guys stayed. This is awesome. I'm shocked.
Thank you.
I'm shocked.